May it please the Court, my name is Walter Dirks. I am counsel for Minority Broadcasting Project. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may.
Whatever's left on the clock will be all yours.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case has been well briefed, so I would like to limit myself to just a few key points that I think would be important for the Court to consider in its consideration of this case. Again, this case involves a statute which prohibits three categories of underwriting announcements on public broadcast stations, while permitting all other underwriting announcements. On its face, it does not permit a underwriting announcement for a for-profit organization promoting its goods and services. It doesn't permit issue advertising or underwriting, doesn't permit political underwriting announcements. It does permit a lot of other commercial speech. It permits image advertising.
Well, let's say we were to agree with you that that is what it does and that it's impermissible. I'm not saying we would, but let me start at the back end. So what is the consequence of that? What would happen then?
Well, first of all, the consequence of – I'm not sure I understood your question.
Let's say we were to agree with you that this is unconstitutional, impermissibly – it's an impermissible statute. Let's say we get there.
Okay. At that point –
And that – what happens then?
At that point, noncommercial broadcasters would have the ability but not the obligation to –
How do you get there?
Well, because
– If it's an unconstitutional statute, why wouldn't we just strike it down?
Right.
And that means no one gets to advertise.
Well, I think that the way it's written, 399B is written in terms of the things that are prohibited. Okay? It says you can't do the – you can't – you cannot have an
underwriting. The status quo ante was that there was no advertising at all. Why wouldn't we just – if we think that the distinctions drawn by the statute are unconstitutional, why wouldn't we just strike down the statute and go back to the day when there was no advertising permitted? Everybody gets treated equally badly, and therefore nobody has a cause for complaint. Why isn't that the appropriate remedy?
Well, because I think that the – you have A and B. B says you can't have an underwriting announcement that has an advertisement. And what we're saying is that distinctions, that the things that the categories, the way it's set up, that the restrictions are unconstitutional. I think you strike A.
No, what you're saying is the distinctions are unconstitutional. They treat some people better than other people.
Correct.
Unconstitutional. And we say, okay, we'll treat everybody just equally badly. Bam. We strike it down, which is the latest thing the Congress passed. It used to be that nobody could advertise. They then let some people in, some people didn't. Why don't we say letting some people in is not good enough? We strike it down. We go back to no advertising. Why doesn't that solve the problem? I mean, that would solve your problem, wouldn't it? All the arguments you have would go away if we did that.
All my arguments would go away. However, I don't think that would.
It wouldn't help your clients. It wouldn't help your clients, but it would help the law, the Constitution. You will have the satisfaction of knowing you helped right or wrong.
You have a constitutional regime. You're saying.
You're not arguing that that regime would be unconstitutional, right?
No, we would not argue that that regime would be unconstitutional. I don't think that would be consistent with the intent of Congress.
Well, if you wanted to do the intent of Congress, we'd uphold the statute. So we're already messing with the intent of Congress. The question is, what is the appropriate degree to do that?
Well, I think you've got two possible remedies. One is you could strike the restrictions, which is what we're urging you to do. The other is you can strike the whole thing. Those are obviously your two options.
And why isn't striking down the whole thing the appropriate remedy if we were to agree with you that there is a constitutional problem?
Well, I think that would be more violence to the scheme than what we're urging you to do.
Well, so you want to strike two and three, not one.
Well, we would urge you to strike all three of them because we don't think any one of them passes constitutional muster for a variety of reasons.
But if that doesn't work, just speaking hypothetically, right, would you rather keep one and then strike two and three?
Well, obviously, we would prefer all three to be stricken, but if that weren't the case, two and three. But two and three, I would suggest to you, is an even greater problem because of the legal women voters observation that the hierarchy of speech has sort of been inverted here, because, you know, you have issue speech and political speech, which are in the highest rung of the Constitution, are prohibited. So I can advertise Girl Scout cookies, but I can't talk about Save the Whales.
But can you please tell me who's, with regard to the political speech and the public issue speech, whose
yes.
First Amendment rights are we talking about here?
I think we're talking about the First Amendment rights of the people who want to put the underwriting
right.
announcements
have,
on.
Is there anything in the record showing there is any such person who wants to put such an ad on minority TV?
Actually, the complaint.
It says that you would like to show such ads. Does it show that anybody in particular ever came to you and said, I'd like to show such an ad?
Well, actually, there was a deposition of the station manager where he talked about that.
And what did he say?
He said that he turned people down, that people wanted to do it.
Did he say who? Did he say when?
He gave some examples of people he had turned down.
So are you asserting your First Amendment rights or the rights of
both.
The advertisers? What standing do you have to assert the First Amendment rights of the advertisers?
I think generally speaking, in the First Amendment context, I represent billboard companies, okay, so we get this issue all the time. We're permitted to assert the First Amendment rights, particularly in the area of non-commercial speech. In addition, the medium of communication, this is Pittsburgh Press case that goes back to sometime in the late 70s, I believe, where the Supreme Court recognized that the advertising medium generally had a right to pick and choose which advertisers it wanted to take.
Well, you're asserting your client's First Amendment rights.
I think we're doing that, too, but I think we also have we also have standing to assert the rights of the people who would speak.
Before I leave you on this one, you are making a First Amendment claim, not an equal protection claim. Am I correct?
I think that's primarily correct, but I think that some of the cases, it's kind of hard to figure out exactly what they're talking about.
I know what the cases say, but as I read your complaint, you assert
I think that's
First Amendment.
That's correct. That's primarily what we're asserting here is that. And I think that, you know, when you take a look at
that.
I'm sorry?
You're asserting that. What's that?
Well, the claims in the complaint are primarily, you know, premised on the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily or entirely?
I'm sorry?
Primarily or entirely? I mean, if you can point me to some place in this record where you've asserted an equal protection claim, I'd like to see it.
I offhand couldn't tell you any. So I think that's fair to say that, you know, this is posited on the First Amendment.
I have another question. You said that your understanding of the provision about the commercial advertising was that it went to any only to profit-making organizations.
Correct.
Where does it say that?
It says it's
intended to promote any service, facility, or product offered by any person who is engaged in such offering for profit.
For profit.
Would that not include a sale of something by a nonprofit organization if they're whether or not the organization is a profit-making organization or not, if they're trying to make money on the thing they're offering?
That's not the position the Federal Communications Commission has taken.
It seems very carefully worded not to turn on whether it's a profit-making or nonprofit organization.
Well, I don't think that anybody has ever taken the position that it applied to a nonprofit who is offering whatever nonprofits are offering in the way of products and services. For example, there is an opinion letter or advisory letter from the FCC in the record involving an inquiry from a broadcast station somewhere in the Midwest about whether it was okay for them to take a underwriting announcement that promoted the services of Planned Parenthood, which is
yes,
a nonprofit.
Yes, but that particular ad, if you read it, is precisely what's on NPR, at least, on every day about for profit-making organizations and nonprofit organizations.
Well,
that's not really an ad.
Well, it really is. And I think that is one of the other issues having to do with vagueness. Okay? But I think that if you read the letter from the FCC, they approached it the way that everybody I'm aware of has approached the way the statute is written, as opposed to what maybe you might think it ought to be in a perfect world, exactly the way it's written. And what they analyzed was that because Planned Parenthood is
right,
not
what
the profit.
I'm asking is whether we could interpret the statute such mm-hmm. as such that the nonprofit mm-hmm. category deals with what my understanding is was mainly meant to deal with, which is fundraising, contributions, soliciting of contributions by nonprofit and offering of free non-cost services, but not necessarily when they're selling something.
Well,
wouldn't that avoid the constitutional problem if we
no,
do that?
No, it wouldn't.
Why
it would,
not?
It would still have the problem of you are permitting what I call the image advertising. Okay? The Ford Motor Company puts on one of these gauzy underwriting announcements where, you know, basically they're saying we're wonderful human beings, you ought to think nicely of us. That is commercial speech. There's no getting away from it. It's commercial speech. And so what you still have the problem that the statute is inverting the hierarchy of the Constitution. It is giving more protection to commercial speech than it is giving to non-commercial speech. That has been a problem going back to the 70s.
It's giving less protection.
Yeah, how does it, could you explain that?
Sure.
Because I can read 1, 2, and 3, and I don't get where you derive that conclusion. So maybe you can fill me in.
I'm the Ford Motor Company. I can put on an ad on what amounts to an ad. It's called the underwriting announcement, but let's just be honest about it. It's an ad.
Do you have an example in there?
I'm sorry?
Do you have an example we can look at?
Well, actually, I can in the record, there are and actually, we quote some in our brief where that were on the radio station, the public radio station in Washington, D.C., which we contended were, you know, show vagueness, but which the FCC says are on the right side of the line. Promoting companies in one way, shape, or form.
What does it say? Where is it in your brief?
I can give you some examples. There,
record somewhere?
Can we? Where, you know, our position is that this shows how vague it is.
Stop! I asked you to show me the text.
Okay, I'm going to try to do that for you.
It's hard to focus on what you're saying.
On page 46 of our initial brief.
The blue brief?
Yes.
That must be the blue brief. Yes. We quote an ad for Hardwood Artisans, really great company in Washington, D.C.
For what?
A fabulous company, a really high-end furniture company. Our classical music is made possible by your membership and car donation and by Hardwood Artisans, creating original designs for over 30 years. From bookcases to Murphy beds to rocking chairs, Hardwood Artisans handcraft furniture to order in Northern Virginia. Simply beautiful furniture. That is not atypical of what runs. There's also up further on the page, there's an underwriting announcement for the Tony Kornheiser show on Washington Post Radio.
Underwriter ad because they gave money to underwrite it?
Correct. That's how it works.
And how is that different from a commercial ad?
I'm sorry, what?
How is that different from a commercial ad?
Well, that's our point. We don't think it is. We think it is a commercial ad.
So you don't have a problem?
No, we do have a problem. Our problem is that...
I'm sorry. What is your problem? Why can't all your advertisers use this as an underwriter ad? They're an underwriter. They send money in. They get...
If I have an issue or I have a political thing, I can't do it. I cannot have an underwriting announcement.
You say our classical music may puzzle the day by your membership and a donation from Joe Snert, who's running for Congress in Maryland, or wherever your station is.
Well, it would be even...
He generously is he's a great guy and a wonderful human being, honest, and as the day is long. And he made a nice contribution to the station, which makes this classical music possible. Why couldn't you do that?
That would be political.
Why?
The same thing if you had a person who...
Sorry, why would that be not permissible, whereas this would be?
Well, it supports or opposes a candidate. It's supporting a candidate. He's saying he's a wonderful guy in the example you gave. You can't do it. If you took the equivalent of the Hardwood Artisans thing, it would be talking about the positions that he had on issues. So you can't do it.
I mean, I don't see how that's different than saying that Hardwood Artisans makes nice furniture.
Well, our position is that actually this particular one I quoted you is an example of demonstrating the vagueness of the promotional by for-profit organizations prohibition. because of where is the line that we get into. We even quote a law review article.
But in fact, there hasn't been a whole lot of trouble in figuring out the line. And the fact is that your client was doing something very different. Your client was having ads in which people were speaking in their own voices and were doing so over the – they were longer, is my understanding, and they were promotional in a somewhat different sense. They, I mean, they were not in the voice of the announcer. They were essentially handing that time over to the advertisers, as I understood it, to put on the same ad they would have put on a commercial station. Is that basically what happened here?
Okay. That is what was involved earlier, but that is not what we're challenging here. This is entirely a facial case. We are not challenging anything to do with
those ads. But you're suggesting that somehow you couldn't have known that those were ads,
well,
but you obviously did.
Let's just talk about what the FCC itself has said about vagueness. We want to talk about vagueness for a minute. In 1992, this is what the FCC said. This is 11 years after the statute was passed. It is the FCC wrote in a public notice that it had become aware of significant uncertainty and controversy concerning various aspects of commission and statutory policy relating to commercial underwriting on noncommercial stations. This is 11 years after the statute's passed. The FCC is acknowledging significant uncertainty and controversy surrounding it. That doesn't strike me, if you listen to it, as a description of the statute.
What you're complaining about is the format of the ads rather than the content.
That
you really want to have more creative ads. That sort of seems to me that's a different challenge than saying, because obviously you can have commercial things. You know, you can have them as underwriting announcements. But you just want to have something that looks more like a Big Mac ad, right?
There are two sort of separate piles of arguments here. One deals totally with the noncommercial prohibitions, okay? And we would contend that under League of Women Voters, that the scrutiny with which you look at that
is
heightened.
Do we have in the record anywhere an example of the kind of an ad that you wanted to show that was a political or issue ad? One. We have one?
We don't, because this is not an as-applied case. This is a facial challenge.
But we're still entitled to have some idea what we're talking about, and we don't seem to have any. I mean, it's not true that you've agreed that there can be that the ads can be limited so they don't interrupt shows, right?
Correct.
You're not challenging that. You're challenging, suppose they said it could be 10 seconds, no more, which is about what they are, usually are. Could that be okay?
Well, except, see, those are things that really aren't required. The statute doesn't deal – one of our contentions with regard to this, and thank you for raising it, is that there are non-speech-related tools available to the government to regulate whatever is perceived to be the issue. The law review article written by a former associate general counsel of the Public Television Association talks about.
All right. Suppose that was the rule.
Okay.
No more than 10 seconds can interrupt a show. And not only that, it has to be in the voice of the announcer. It can't be in a third-party voice.
Okay.
That's all okay. All okay.
Well, those are time, place, and manner. That is not content-based. The problem we had is
now,
that
do we have any reason to think any issue person or candidate has ever wanted to put on such an ad?
All we do know is what is in the deposition of my client, where he said he turned people down.
He said who people? What they wanted to do?
Who wanted to do political ads?
He said who
issue.
They were, what they wanted?
He did.
Yeah, who are
he
they?
Did it to,
I don't
point, remember
seeing
it. It's not in the record because this had this point.
Well, it's
the
not in the record. That's not in the record.
It went to the whole standing part of this, and as soon as the government realized that my client wasn't, you know, just making it up, that in fact he had opportunities to take this advertising and was turning it down, the standing issue went away.
No, but I think if there's a serious question about whether a particular endorsement or whatever we're going to call it is permissible, you can ask the FCC. Is that right?
You can, but the problem with that is that sounds suspiciously like a prior restraint. There are no time limits.
Well,
there are no time limits, and you don't have the normal. You know, when the Supreme Court has looked about things with his label prior restraints.
Let me ask it this way. It sounds as though the FCC has been in the business of saying yes or no in the fashion of giving guidelines. Is that, or guidance, is that right?
You can write them asking for guidance, but they're under no obligation to get back to you in a timely manner.
But that's a different issue. I mean, you're down the road to,
that's right. we're not
a regulatory challenge.
Right. We're not dealing with that right now.
Let's go back to how it all started. First of all, there's no advertising. Then the FCC undertakes an extensive study. There's notice, comment, public comment, et cetera. And then Congress moves in and passes a statute. So why isn't there sufficient record here for what Congress did? Because, as Judge Kaczynski said, maybe the answer is, okay, no advertising. That's where you started.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be constitutional in your view?
It would be constitutional. You could argue that whether it's wise government policy,
okay,
but it would be
so
constitutional.
So that would be constitutional.
Absolutely.
So that's where we start. No advertising, constitutional, no problem. Now, after notice comment, debate on the floor, Congress comes in and says, We've heard what you said, but we've reconsidered because we think there should be some exceptions from the flat-out ban. What's wrong with that?
Well, a number of things. First of all, that our contention is that they drew the line in unconstitutional ways. The other thing is a speech-related.
Let's start there.
Okay.
They drew the line in an unconstitutional way.
Correct.
What's unconstitutional?
They're favoring commercial speech over non-commercial speech. That's the first problem. That has been a problem all the way back to 1981 when Metro Media.
I think that you mean the opposite, don't you?
They're favoring commercial over non-commercial.
How?
They're permitting certain commercial speech. Image advertising, promotion of goods and services by nonprofits.
But that depends upon your answer to Judge Kaczynski that I'm not sure is borne out based on the materials we have here in front of us. Judge Kaczynski asked, well, what's to prevent candidate Joe Blow from asking that his logo be presented in the same way that Exxon presents its logo?
That would be...
Thank you, Judge Fletcher. You said it so much better than I did.
Okay. It's supporting or opposing a candidate. You couldn't do the equivalent of the Hardwood Artisan ad that I just read to you, because that clearly would be promoting a candidate for public office.
Say you, but why?
Well, if you listen to the statute, the statute says support or opposing a candidate. If I say...
In the statute, it looks to me like the Hardwood Artisan's ad wouldn't fly either. But you say it does, so now I'm confused.
It is still content-based.
Is it?
Yes.
What if the ad were... Let's take the governor of California. This program is brought to you by a generous grant from Governor Jerry Brown. Is that support or oppose a political candidate?
Unlikely.
Yeah. So take a more generous governor. Pick one of your choice. Does that violate the statute?
I think it probably does.
Why?
Because it's promoting or opposing a candidate. Because
It says any ad which is intended to support or oppose.
Right. Now, is anybody
I don't see the word promote in the statute.
Well, a support or oppose is a political candidate going to spend advertising dollars as campaign funds on an underwriting announcement which is not supporting his candidacy.
That's his choice.
Well,
he wants to spend his money.
If you put your name, a typical billboard, don't go back to billboard law because that's what I know best. One of the things about billboards is...
I wouldn't go to billboard law when we're in the broadcast arena.
Because in billboards, lots of times people promote their candidacy because billboards are a unique medium where you have to just glance at it and that's the end of it. You can't sit down and read it because you're driving at 55 miles an hour. A lot of political ads just have the name of the candidate. That's all they have.
But we know with regard to commercial ads that it's okay to put the logo of the person and that is not considered promoting any service, facility, or product. So why would putting a candidate be supporting or opposing a candidate?
You can promote the company, but you can't promote its products or services.
Well, I don't know. When you say they make great furniture and you're putting the logo of a furniture company, it sounds to me like you're promoting the product. This is your example. You came up with it.
If they had just said this was brought to you by Hardwood Artisans, it wouldn't have been a problem. Nobody would have a problem that violated the statue, okay?
Yeah, but it says from bookcases to merchandise.
Pardon me?
I said maybe it violates the statute. I mean, maybe the FCC has got it wrong on interpreting the statute, but that doesn't make the statute unconstitutional.
Yeah, you're making a facial challenge. You're saying that this can't be done without violating the Constitution. I think there's a set – you might have a separate challenge if the FCC regulations overburden you, but let's get back to your facial challenge. What's wrong with the statute facially?
What's wrong with the statute facially is that it permits commercial speech while prohibiting categories of non-commercial speech.
But it doesn't even do that, because if you want to – it only does it if you're paying for it, if you are being paid for it, right?
That's correct.
So if you want to put that same picture on if you're not being paid for it, that's fine. So you don't have a First Amendment problem, because you can do whatever you want.
Well, except that under Pittsburgh Press, the Supreme Court recognized the right, generally speaking, of the news medium or any medium of mass communication to accept or reject advertising.
Okay.
That was an issue in Pittsburgh Press. And they said, yeah, generally speaking, you have the right, but in this case you don't, because the person is proposing what amounts to an illegal transaction. Mm-hmm. But by the by, they acknowledge that. Generally speaking, you know, that case is near and dear to me because I used to be a general counsel for a newspaper.
4 minutes.
I'd like to reserve if I might. Thank you.
Okay. We'll now hear from somebody on the appellee side. Are you Mr. Stern?
Yes, Your Honor, that would be me, Mark Stern, for the government. 2 points, I think, came through from discussion with my brother counsel, which are, one, this is a facial challenge to a statute, and two, the scheme would be valid in counsel's view, but for the fact that Congress did not specifically bar certain kinds of ads. So that the that's all that we have before us is the question is that a basis for facially invalidating the statute? And we think on
it can be, right? If they say, if the statute says you can accept Republican ads, no Democrat ads, bam, that would be unconstitutional.
That's right. We're not saying you that.
So you can. There's nothing theoretically.
That could be a.
There's nothing theoretically impossible about a facial challenge.
Absolutely not. But this facial challenge.
Before you get to the substance of it, can you just spend a couple of minutes talking about the standard by which we judge this? Is it strict scrutiny? Is it intermediate scrutiny? Is it rational basis scrutiny?
Well, we think it's certainly not strict scrutiny.
Why not?
Well, it's not a viewpoint-based discrimination. And
it sure is.
I'm just constrained to.
I mean, isn't it making distinctions between subjects? You know, certain subjects are prohibited.
Well, I think that's what makes it content-based. Is the panel, all members of the panel, I think, correctly recognized that it was content-based. We haven't argued otherwise. What we do think, however, is that the.
Well, how exactly is it content-based? It seems to be saying, essentially, that whether you're a candidate or a person selling something or a person with selling your views, you can't – let's leave two out of it for now because I don't know if that's even in the case exactly. But one in three, they seem to be parallel. I mean, in that each of them is saying – they're addressing different kinds of ads, but they're basically saying the same thing about them, which is you can't – you can – say you can mention these things, but you can't promote them.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean,
what's content-based? Why isn't it treating political candidates and products the same rather than differently?
I don't want to argue against myself, but I think that the argument in favor of the notion that it's content-based is that you have to look to see what the content of the speech
well,
is.
Well, why? If it's saying whether you're a candidate or you're selling an ad, the same thing applies. You can't be promotional, but you can say that you're supporting something.
I think, Your Honor, I'm happy to accept the view that that's not content-based. We've looked at it as being that you look to the content. On the other hand, we also think that this comes within the context of the relaxed scrutiny that's appropriate for this kind of spectrum scarcity limited where you have here, I mean, let's just go back one
second. This is Red Lion, right?
It is Red Lion.
Why hasn't Red Lion been overtaken by events?
Well, if the Supreme Court decides that it has, it will be. But in the meantime, and I think
you have to wait for the Supreme Court. I mean, when they issued an opinion about buggy whips at a time when people drove buggies, we might look at the case now and say, well, you know, it doesn't really apply. And if it's a rationale decided, what was Red Lion was 67, 68,
that's
when
right.
The only way to reach a mass audience was by broadcast spectrum, we might say, well, you know, that just rationale just doesn't apply anymore because hardly anybody views things through the airwaves anymore. It's a small part of the whole market. You've got your cable, you've got your satellite, you've got your internet.
It's about 13% actually, which is
it's different from 100%, right?
Certainly different from 100%.
It was 100% when Red Lion was decided,
yeah,
right?
It's probably close to it. Yeah, I mean,
but why isn't Red Lion a dead letter, and we should just sort of say the Supreme Court just hasn't gotten around to overturning it, but we know it will.
I think that the court, like in Agostini versus Felton, cautioned the courts of appeals to wait for it to overrule a doctrine, and the courts of appeals have continued to apply Red Lion both in the original sort of over the air and also in the satellite context where we also have spectrum scarcity. And go back, this comes up again, go back to 1952, and this is in essence a structure that has been in place since the very inception of an idea of public educational radio or subsequently television. We go back to the originally even in the 30s, where you start having set-asides of licenses for educational television, for educational radio originally. And now, subsequently, educational television. These licenses, the people who get these are set aside. They're free. You don't engage in competitive bidding. There are a lot of advantages to coming in and getting one of these set aside licenses.
But they are far less valuable today than they were in 1952, in the sense that if you didn't get a license like this in 52, there was just no way you could reach a mass market. You might be able to publish a newspaper, which would reach some people, but if you wanted to get into people's homes, you wanted to get into people's cars, you wanted to get into sort of direct contact with the audience on a mass basis, that was it. The spectrum was it. There was nothing else.
Yeah, I think
The world is very different today, right?
It is. This is a slightly different point, I think, that I'm trying to make than the spectrum scarcity point, which is that it is true that there are more ways in which the programming gets distributed. But on the license point, if you want to get into the game to start out with, regardless of how your program is ultimately going to get carried, you've got to get the license.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Well,
if you want to say I'm going to do a show and just do it on YouTube.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Do you need a license from the FCC?
No.
And you can reach millions and millions of people much more than any radio station did in 1952 today from your desktop at home getting a law license from anybody.
That possibility
did not exist in 52 or 67 when Red Lion was decided. Why isn't all that ancient history now? Why should we treat this whatever the Supreme Court said there, and having any validity today in a world where this is such a small part of the market, and there are so many more ways? Remember, we're talking about the First Amendment. We're talking about an exception to one of the fundamental rights were granted by the Bill of Rights, and that is this right to speak. And the Supreme Court says, well, there's an exception because this is such a unique and limited opportunity for people to reach.
But
no longer exists. You've got YouTube. We live in the world of YouTube.
Your Honor, I think that aside from the fact that there are whole new alternatives other than television and radio, I think that the crucial point for this case is we're not talking about a general regulation of all radio stations or television stations, which is what Red Lion, in those cases, are fundamentally addressed to. And one could even question the validity of Red Lion in other contexts. But here, what we have is in the general world in which you can do all the advertising of any kind that you want to, there is a small spectrum of television and radio, and that's the universe we're talking about. It's the only universe. There's a small spectrum in which Congress has said, let us try to develop, based on a different economic model, a wholly different kind of programming. That's been the case for 60 years. The argument here is that because 30-some years ago, Congress, when it codified a slight relaxation of that principle, didn't specifically address ads for persons that are where the promotion is not for profit, that the entire scheme should come crashing down.
Well, Mr. Stern, I would like, since you're getting into that area, I wanted to ask you something about the record that we have in this case. In the League of Women Voters, the Supreme Court requires that a restriction on speech must be substantially advance the government's substantial interest. And in this case, how do the restrictions on political and public issue ads advance the government's interest in this case? And the record, the case against commercial ads is addressed in the record, but what in the record concerning political and public issues are, where is that in the record? And should this be remanded to the district court to take a further evidence on restrictions on political and public issue ads?
No, I think not, and I think that there is a that there is an error in the panel's reasoning when it says that there is no discussion of sort of commercial ads. And the error, I think, is that all the discussion in Congress by everybody, when they're talking about the commercialization, they're not distinguishing between some ads for a laundry detergent.
What they mean is getting paid for.
Exactly. That's what they're talking about. It's absolutely clear when you go through the record that at every point, that's what people are talking about, and the history makes clear that they're talking about money for political.
At least Congress saw this as economic regulation, not a speech regulation.
Absolutely. It is economic regulation. It's part of.
Well, but it's economic regulation that affects speech.
Of
in the
course.
Sense that the whole premise is if you dump a bunch of money in, there go you change the outcome in terms of your programming, and the only way, presumably, to have some semi-pristine programming is to basically draw the line. So it's it's speech regulation in the form of economic regulation.
Exactly,
right?
And that's exactly right. And
but couldn't you say, though, that speaking, the political speech and the public issue speech are core First Amendment rights, which are different than commercial speech, and do we have to read the record the way that you're saying it?
I think so, Your Honor, because it is so clear that throughout.
Well, if it were so clear, we probably wouldn't be here.
No, I don't think that's right, Your Honor, because there's no discussion. All the testimony doesn't distinguish between the different kinds of ads for sale. And the reason that there's virtually no discussion of nonprofits is that there has never been any significant amount of nonprofit advertising anywhere. So this is sort of a red herring.
Well, can I ask you a question about the record? This troubles me in this case. Could Congress have passed this statute without a record at all?
I think that particularly in this case, given what Congress was doing was acting on the basis of 30-some years of FCC regulation.
Is Congress required to take testimony and make a record before it passes a statute?
No, I think Judge Paez's dissent explains very clearly why that is not the case. And here, what we have is this legislation is preceded by a very extensive FCC rulemaking proceeding, and Congress essentially comes in and says, okay, I think you went a little too far in what you did here. It says, I'm not going to let you go quite as far as you did, but imposes restrictions, but it modifies what the FCC did. So this is Congress acting in response, in part, to an extensive rulemaking.
So if instead of the FCC, a citizen had come to Senator so-and-so and said, Here's a great idea for changing the statute. It used to be wholly inclusive, and now we want to be a little bit looser. And the senator said that's a great idea and sold it to all of his colleagues, and the House adopted it. Would there be a constitutional deficiency in that process?
No, there certainly wouldn't be a deficiency in the process.
Then when you're confronted thereafter with the challenge that this is facially unconstitutional, how do you defend it in the absence of a congressional record?
Well, I mean, the Supreme Court has said that there are things that are just sort of sufficiently clear that you can – that Congress can be understood to have understood them.
You know, I don't think you need to bite off all of that. Turner makes it pretty clear that we need to look somehow to what Congress had in its head and that there is some substantial support for what it did. Now, I don't think that that has to be read only to the 81 hearings. Clearly, Congress is legislating against a backdrop, against a bunch of experience. But I don't think the answer out of Turner is that a congressman can sneak something in as a rider to a defense appropriations bill that limits free speech and that that's sufficient record. But that's not the case we've got in front of us.
Don't argue that case. I'm happy to accept that suggestion, Your Honor.
Judge Hurwitz was sort of drawing you down the rabbit hole there. Yeah. I mean, Turner does say there has to be some record, right?
Yes, and there is plenty of record evidence. I mean, and also, look, usually when we're talking about upholding Congress.
What is it? I mean, I was trying to find what there was record evidence, and I wasn't. I mean, there's some stuff in the district court record here, but what was there? What record evidence was
there? What we have, I mean, and it's partly a question of what court thinks that we need record evidence.
I'm willing to let you tell us.
Well, And
then we'll decide whether it's good enough.
That sounds good.
That's how it works.
It's very fair.
Sorry. Would you go back, I think, though?
Well, how about answering my question first?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you did.
No, I don't think you did.
That would have been good.
So tell us what there was for Congress supporting Congress's decision.
Okay. What we have is we've got, and, you know, I don't want to sort of belabor it, but we've got 30 years of the FCC regulating the availability and the possibility of doing advertising at the time that Congress acts. We have extensive.
That's so vague. What does that mean?
Well, what it means is that the FCC had specifically recognized from the outset, and it repeated, and it studied this when these issues kept coming up, and what it repeatedly recognized was that it was authorizing a different economic model, and that the model of advertising, paying for airtime, that kind of commercialization, was antithetical to the creation of a wholly different kind of programming there, which would feature programming that
Let me be specific, because you're going on stuff that doesn't matter. What is it that supports the distinction Congress do? For a long time, there was prohibition, and nobody's arguing that a total prohibition would be a constitutional. Nobody here has argued that. So you don't have to go on and on telling us that a prohibition is constitutional. The question is, specifically, what was the support, the distinction drawn by Congress? But it said, if you have, issue ads, political ads, and commercial ads can't be, you can't have advertisers for that, but you can have it for nonprofit groups and donor acknowledgments. What evidence is there supporting that distinction?
Well, if the distinction is for the nonprofit groups,
yes,
there is nothing. But there are a couple of points.
I'm sorry. I'm not aware of any evidence
about nonprofit groups. Let's understand that this is. What we have here is, to the extent that Congress did anything, it didn't specifically legislate with regard to them. If the Court thought it was a problem, the Court could read this to say that the FCC would not be allowed to allow anybody to advertise, because the statute doesn't say that the FCC can't authorize it. The FCC concluded in the wake of.
I'm sorry. Are you saying we can just roll it back?
Yeah. What Your Honor suggested could be a comment. I'm not saying you should. I don't think that there's any reason to do it doctrinally. I'm just saying Your Honor's suggestion of
– I'm sorry. I asked you what supports a distinction, and you said nothing. But you could just treat it as if the distinction didn't exist, which sounds to me what you're saying is there's nothing to support the distinction, and therefore you should roll it back and say there's no advertising at all. Why don't you give me another solution? Why don't you explain to me how we could uphold the current scheme, given that you answered the question, what's in the record, with the word nothing? Given that there's nothing in the record to support the distinction, how could we uphold the distinction under Turner?
Your Honor, the distinction here –
unless the government wants to say, no, you don't support the distinction.
Your Honor, I think we've tried very hard in our briefs, perhaps unsuccessfully, to persuade you at this point. Certainly, we hope that Judge Paez did better. But our point is certainly that the that the discovery network analysis that is invoked by the majority doesn't
– You know, let me interrupt. You're not playing – you're not describing the 81 record in a way that's very helpful to you. Here's the problem that was confronting Congress in 1981. The federal support for public radio, educational radio and TV was falling. And they were trying to figure out a way how additional money could be brought in without endangering the basic mission of educational or public television and radio. And the question then was, well, how much can we allow for paid sponsorship, logos, and so on without endangering it? For example, you would get testimony at 81 hearing from the head of GTE who says, I don't do any sponsorship for public TV because I can't put my logo up there. I mean, I've read most of that 81 hearing, and it's clear that that's the problem they're at. How can we get some money coming in from other sources without endangering the basic mission? And it's very clear that they say, well, here's what we can do without endangering, and then they draw the line. I mean, why didn't you tell us that? That's what's in the record.
Your Honor, I couldn't hope to say it as well as you just did.
Well, we all have that problem with Judge Fletcher. He always says it better. So let's put aside the logo ads. I'm not even talking about the logo ads because Judge Fletcher has explained the reason. But what about the non-profit groups part? What is there in the record to support that distinction, saying letting in money from non-profit groups? I take it if the ACLU comes up or the Heritage Foundation comes up with an ad saying Heritage Foundation protecting America as we know it, or ACLU has an ad saying protecting your rights every day in every state in the country, you know, something like that, that would be permissible, right?
It likely would be. I don't want to speak for the commission.
It would be permissible, and it happens every day as well for a profit-making organization to get on and say there's one, such-and-such diabetes organization helping people overcome diabetes every day.
Yes.
Dedicated to that purpose. That's what goes on in PR. It's no different. It's the same.
Yes.
I'm sorry. That's okay? I'm sorry. That's permissible under the statute, right?
If I understood the question correctly, yes.
Okay. So why – what is there in the record, in the congressional record before Congress, saying ads for cars or hamburgers are corrupting and will destroy public television, whereas ads for these companies will not do that? Maybe some sort of non-profits, like the diabetes ad or the ACLU ad or the Heritage ad. What is it to say that the distinction is a valid one?
Your Honor, I mean, the record does what the representatives of GBH sort of explain are, one, that to the extent that, A, there are very few. Two, to the extent that they exist, nonprofits tend to be positioning themselves in much the same way as sort of like underwriting
announcements. I'm sorry. This isn't the congressional record?
No, I think that's in the declaration.
Why don't you go to the Roger Noll affidavit?
Yes.
And tell us, because those speak directly to all these questions that are raised, what effect do those have post-congressional enactment in terms of our analysis?
Okay. I don't mean to stop. I realize there's stuff in the district court record, but I specifically want to focus on what's before Congress, because Turner said that. If you say there's nothing before Congress and we need to move on to district court, that's fine. I just want to get it out of you one way or the other. Is the answer is there was nothing on that distinction before Congress?
Your Honor, the short answer is going to be yes, but if I could make a slightly longer answer.
Yes, there are no bananas?
Yes, there are no bananas, Your Honor. I'll be quoted on that. But if I could go back to Judge Fletcher's larger framework.
Well, I do want you to acknowledge Judge McEwen's point that there is stuff in the district court record.
I think that's very important. But I just want to make clear that what Congress was doing was indeed acting against a declining federal support for public television and broadcasting. It was looking to loosen regulations in a way that would provide alternative revenue sources without undermining.
And it decided commercial is bad, non-commercial is good. And the question is there any evidence before Congress to support that notion?
It is not really what Congress did. That I would resist. That is not what it did, what it didn't do, and it's what we normally, the only way that the failure to specifically address advertisements for certain groups for promoting services could be thought to present the First Amendment.
I had raised this question about whether the statute actually makes that distinction. The statute says that it doesn't talk about profit-making groups and non-profit-making groups. It says to promote any service, facility, or product offered by any person who is engaged in such offering, that is, as to that product, for a profit. So if somebody is selling tickets to an opera, does that not count as selling them for profit, even though in the end it's a 501c3?
Your Honor, I don't think the FCC has interpreted it that way, but again.
I mean, why isn't that what it says? Why it doesn't say anything about a profit-making person.
I think it probably interprets it that way because of the IRS code.
Judge Newman has a question.
I take it you agree that political speech is on the highest rung of the ladder. It's the highest value. It preserves our democracy. Now tell me, I have not got it out of you, why is it permissible to ban political speech and yet permit a variety of commercial speech?
Because what we're talking about are all commercial speeches. These are all
political speech is advocating the election of someone.
Yes, Your Honor, but just to be clear, nobody is restricting the ability of any station to air political speech or debate. What the scheme does is to say that there are not going to be ads promoting candidates. And it's done not in, remember, this is the context of this discreet, narrow, publicly supported area in which Congress has bent over backwards for 60 years.
Why does it become less political if it's on broadcast? I just don't get it.
Because it's not the entire broadcast spectrum.
No, it isn't. But it's one suppression of political speech.
Your Honor, it's a segment in which the reasons for this, like, are...
What's the reason for suppressing political speech?
It's the reason is that this is the same, even though the panel decision said that the two, that there were entirely different considerations.
Well, what is the reason? Tell me the reason.
Because we have $3 billion that was spent last year on political advertising and the commercial...
But that wasn't spent on this, because they couldn't know whether they did. Nobody knows what the would be spent on in this area.
There's $3 billion that were spent on political advertising on radio and television in the 2012 election season.
Is that part of our permissible record?
Well, it's certainly a matter that's subject to public notice. But
it's not really even part of the district court record, right?
But the $2.2 billion figure was part of the district court record.
Would you look at the district court record and explain what, in your view, effect that has in terms of upholding the statute after the fact in terms of congressional rationale?
Your Honor, the Turner, which is explicitly says if there was not a – if it wasn't clear what the basis was for taking an action was before Congress, that the appropriate course would be, as it did in that case, to remand to the district court for proceedings. And Professor Knoll, who, like, presented a declaration here, is one of the same people who appeared and provided evidence in Turner. This is the way it's – the district court – we said to the district court, you can rule without taking additional evidence. The district court said, I want to hear additional evidence. We provided a lot of evidence. It all goes to the same point. This is – we are talking about the constitutionality of an act of Congress. And if, when we have evidence that supports it, to strike it down would really be unprecedented. And again, also with regard to predictive judgments, usually when you're looking at predictive judgments, you don't know how it's going to turn out.
So,
would
counsel,
it be a problem?
When you told the district court that you didn't need the additional evidence, what evidence were you relying upon to support the statute at that point?
We were looking at the fact that there was an extensive regulatory record, plus there were witnesses before Congress from public radio and public broadcasting who all made the same points. And we here
– Can I ask one question before you finish on a slightly different point? This is a very unusual station in that it gets no public money. Almost all the other ones do. Does that make any difference, i.e. Well, what I'm wondering is this. If this – if there was public money, as there would be – is this case a one-off, in other words? Because if we – the justifications for having these restrictions may differ if there is a chunk of public money in there.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that they do. We think that – that – that there's still – that this station acquired its license. It's like it has a major advantage.
I understand that, but I'm saying that you would have a set of other arguments, would you not, if there were public money involved?
Yeah, there would be even more, but look, this is endangering the entire structure because what happens is the – this comes up because competing stations said, look, these guys who enjoy all the advantages of an educational television license are airing the kinds of ads we want to run.
No,
but that's very important. They're operating on a playing field that's designed for people who do not go in to compete.
But for 99% of the public TV stations, the whole Red Lion issue wouldn't really be the issue because the other stations are getting being subsidized by the federal government, giving the federal government a lot more
room. Well, these people are being subsidized, too. That's what you get when you get a free license. That's a very serious thing. And you get – there's enormous tax subsidies. Like, the subsidy that gets, like, indirectly to all of these stations because all of the donations that people call in are tax-deductible is, I believe, just about as great in terms of the actual benefit that accrues to them as the direct subsidies from CBD.
Is there a separate set of regulations that come from the funding that lead to the same place? Does the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the statutes that regulate that provide similarly or wrap in the set of regulations as a condition of receiving federal money,
no,
not just of receiving the station?
No. CPD has guidelines that it issues itself for its participants, but they are not Congress. The only requirements, in, as far as I'm aware, in the whole public area are this, that if you're going to get the license, you do it, you promote a non-commercial. That was the word that appears in the fundamental statute.
You have one of these licenses to get Corporation for Public Broadcasting money?
No, excuse me, Your Honor?
You have to be such an
Yes, I believe so. You have to – there's a small subset, which includes minority television, that does not take CPB money.
That's not what I'm asking. You asked the opposite question. To get CPB money, do you need to have one of these licenses?
Yes. Yes. I mean, they all need to have the license.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate the time.
You had the better part of 4 minutes. We'll generously round it up to 4 minutes.
I'm going to bounce around here, so I apologize in advance. First of all, Mr. Stern said that we're only complaining about the inversion, the commercial versus non-commercial distinction.
We have not abandoned any of the arguments we've made below. That just happened to be the one we wound up spending a lot of time on. So, you know, we're clinging to every argument we made below. With regard to the strict scrutiny point that Judge Kaczynski raised, I would just refer you to the quotes we have from the Citizens United case where they refused to make a distinction between broadcast, satellite, and cable, where the parties actually sensing that there might be a strict scrutiny versus intermediate scrutiny argument tried to make that distinction before the Court. The Court said, we're treating it all the same, strict scrutiny. Also, if you look at the Brown case, the violent video games case, which originated here, again, the Supreme Court lumped broadcast in with all the things that were entitled to strict scrutiny. So I think you have a lot of support for that, but I don't want
to waste
too much of my time on that.
To what extent is the point that you're getting a free license and therefore a subsidy for the government, to what extent does that, and by accepting that, you've accepted a restrictions that go along with it. Isn't there some validity to that argument?
Well, I think it's an absurd argument because all private stations, all commercial stations originally got their license for free, too. Nobody paid for them. So you could say the same argument could be used with regard to for any broadcast station. And the thing is, if you go back to legal union voters.
Excuse me.
Yes.
The license you have, however, has particular conditions, and you couldn't have gotten it without meeting those conditions.
Every licensee has particular conditions.
Yes, but you would have been competing in a much broader realm if you had not promised to meet those conditions.
Having competed for broadcast licenses, I'm not sure that's correct. There is tremendous competition for every broadcast license, whether it's commercial or non-commercial.
Well, that's not the point, though. If there's commercial, there's non-commercial. Once you decide to go one route or the other, you accept those conditions, correct?
Well, except that you can't accept an unconstitutional condition which is imposed upon you later. League of Women Voters, that case involved only stations that were getting public money from the federal government.
But you agreed to be a non-commercial station, correct?
Well, we agreed to abide by the terms of our license.
Which includes being a non-commercial
at that time
station.
Did. But they changed the game. And what we're complaining about is they changed the game where they drew lines that were content-based, unconstitutional restrictions.
So really, for your client's sake, you'd like to go back to zero where there's not even any possibility of any sponsorships or additional money coming in as revenue to the company, correct?
Well, they would prefer not to have that result. They would prefer you to strike the restrictions. But, you know, they're not the ones making the decision.
Let me ask you this, if I may, and I think the answer can be quick. Are we permitted in terms of what we can consult for support for the congressional judgment, are we permitted to look at the Osier and Noel affidavits presented to the district court?
I think it's a two-step process. In our response to the petition for rehearing, we laid this out in great detail.
Is the answer yes or no?
No, it's a two-step process.
Well, but can we look at them?
Only after you determine that there is substantial evidence in the record before Congress. You can look through it then.
Is this based on Turner, or are you claiming that there is a general rule for any First Amendment? Just a minute.
Okay.
For any First Amendment challenge to any state or local or federal statute that you can only rely on records before the legislative body, whether it's a city council or a state legislature or Congress, or where does this rule come from?
I think you have to look at Turner 1 and Turner 2.
But that's just one subcase. But there either is a general rule that applies to First Amendment cases in general, or there isn't one. Is there a general rule?
I think the Turner, it applies generally. And
Can you think of any other instance in which it's been applied?
Yes. In our response to the petition for rehearing, we discussed the decisions from four circuits. The one that's the most complete, which really gives you an absolute roadmap, is from the Fourth Circuit.
Outside the area of broadcasting, is there any example?
None that come to mind.
No, none. It's all in
the broadcast area.
So why? But Turner was not this kind of a broadcast case because it wasn't based on the scarcity rule. It was on a completely different premise.
Okay, but the thing is that the framework has been applied. Okay, and I think if you look at the other cases, including the FCC's brief in the case we cited from the D.C. Circuit, they admit that there has to be substantial evidence in the record before Congress.
Well, they may admit it, but I'd like to know where this rule is coming from.
I think it comes from Turner 1 and Turner 2.
Which isn't this kind of a case.
Well, it's actually, that was a content-neutral case, and we're talking about a content-based case.
It was a case in which it was precisely not about broadcast stations. It was about non-broadcast stations.
Actually, Turner, too, has been applied recently in a case from this Court, now that I just think about it. There's a case, Valle de Sol, which was decided on March 4th, which makes reference to Turner.
Oh, good. We can overrule it. No,
I'm just saying it. You were asking me to come up in another context, and my first reaction was that, gee, I don't remember Turner, the Turner case is being cited anywhere else. I don't remember the details, but I know that the Turner cases are cited in that case.
Thank you.
Okay.
The case is argued with stand submitted. We're adjourned.
Thank you for your indulgence.
This Court is adjourned.
I should make put it on mute.